I want to turn this over for the panel on redistricting and districting and other ways of approaching the geographic dimension of political representations. I want to turn this over to Keisha Gaskins of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, formerly of the Brennan Center, and she will introduce the other panelists.
Great, thanks, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning. Okay, we're going to try again. I know it's snowing. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. So I want to thank everyone for allowing us to share this time and talk about redistricting. As part of the systems we've been discussing today and these past couple days, as we think about overall government dysfunction, with the possible exception of congressional rulemaking, redistricting is probably one of the most arcane. Citizens generally seem less familiar with redistricting, and although it happens in tens of thousands of jurisdictions all over the country, in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, it happens only once every 10 years. The other challenge, as we think about redistricting and districts and drawing district lines, are challenges around the process and political mechanics of redistricting, and then the challenges of districting as a problem in terms of representation. I think another area, as we think about districting and district representation, is we tend to, as we think about the frames, talk about it very much in partisan terms. How are we in terms of proportionality? How does it actually represent the parties? And not always in terms of actual quality of representation. What does it actually mean for citizens who make up these districts? What does it actually mean to have a more diverse district? Is competition that we frequently seek as a priority really the best way to represent citizens, or do citizens really prefer to be represented a different type of way? And all these things sort of play into the idea of what is best for redistricting, but it's not always clear what is best for redistricting, district, and representation. Will that serve some of the challenges around government function and in fact, dysfunction? So in today's panel, we hope to get to some of these core questions and how redistricting itself plays into the larger government dysfunction challenges. And I think what is sort of the goal of, as I understand it, of part of this process in the past these couple days, as opposed to finding that one, to use a phrase, silver bullet to solve the problems, to try and figure out what is the secret sauce? What are the pieces we can take from here and there to try and figure out exactly where we want government to go, how we want these systems to operate together? And the real challenge, one of the challenges for redistricting, is how do we think about redistricting in that role? Where does it fit in that sort of secret sauce of government dysfunction? And so we have some really great people on the panel today that I think are going to be really helpful in arriving at finding some clarity to the questions. In fact, you all may have the exact answers, but I don't know if that's the goal of today, is to fix the problem. So, unfortunately, Professor Michael McDonald from George Mason was scheduled to be on the panel today, and the weather that did many of us in also made it impossible for Michael to be here, so we are going to miss his voice. To my immediate left, of course, we have Rob Ritchie. Rob has directed Fair Vote's work since 1992. Fair Vote is a leader in advancing alternative voting and districting systems. Its work on multi-member districts, cumulative voting, and ranked choice voting has been essential to introducing and championing these changes in jurisdictions across the country. To his left, we have Kathy Fang. Kathy is the executive director of Common Cause California and the director of Common Cause's redistricting work nationally. Kathy was integral to passing the redistricting reforms in California and has a really important voice here with us today. And batting cleanup, we have Tom Sands. He's the president and general counsel of MALDEF. He's also served as counsel to the Los Angeles mayor, Antonio Villagrosa. So we're going to hear from everyone today, and we'll give everyone 5 minutes to set out the frame of the conversation. I have a few questions that are framed, and then we'll open it up to the floor. Rob.
Great.
Great. Well, thank you. Great event. Thanks so much to Brennan and to all those who made this possible. There were handouts on your chair, so just take a look at those. I'm going to refer to the one that has the lovely multicolored maps there of some southern states. A fundraising thing got in there. It wasn't actually meant to be a fundraising thing, but hey, you know, that's okay. My 5 minutes, I am going to try to explain the value of a ranked choice ballot, explain what a multi-seat district is versus a single-member district, review the impact of a ranked choice ballot in a multi-seat district, briefly contrast with a single-member district approaches, and do a roadmap for change. Okay, got 4.5 minutes. Ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting is where you don't vote for one person, you get to rank them in order of choice. And so if you have more than two candidates running, in some ways there's almost, I think, almost a ranked choice imperative that you should be able to say something about more than one person if you want to. So you have a first choice, you have a second choice, you have a third choice. You treat it, the word instant runoff comes from the fact that you can take those rankings and simulate a traditional runoff election by dropping whoever is the weakest candidate in the last place, eliminating that candidate, looking at those ballots cast for them, moving them to their second choice, seeing if you have a winner, continuing, and so you get down to two, and you simulate a runoff. And then so that's a system that kind of deals with spoilers, split votes, and has drawn some interest in a variety of settings. One example, by the way, is when we're talking about primaries earlier, and we're talking about top two. The problem with the top two system, the biggest problem from my perspective, is that it's still too determinative. Only two people emerge, and that usually determines who is going to win the general election. If you accommodated more than two candidates with, say, four candidates, you can use a ranked choice ballot and suddenly have a much more representative choice in the general election. It's the way that sort of example of how a ranked choice ballot can be used. Relating to the conversation yesterday about money in politics, a very interesting use of ranked choice voting last November was in Minneapolis in its mayoral election. There were a number of candidates that ran, definitely a less polarizing kind of election. It was open seat. And the candidate had the most money, did a pretty traditional campaign, did TV ads, tried to get out his base, was expected to win. And then there was a candidate who did no TV ads. She put all her money into candidate contact and ultimately soared past him, both in first choices and in getting better at second and third choices as the other candidates were eliminated and won big. And it creates some different incentives for how you run. Multi-seat district versus single-member district. So we actually have a lot of history of multi-seat districts in this country. It just basically means you have a fewer number of bigger districts and you have more than one representative. So actually in the first 50 years of Congress, about a quarter of members were elected in multi-seat districts. 50, 60 years ago, more than half of state legislators were elected from multi-seat districts. I still have a three-seat district in Maryland. Those were almost all winner-take-all. And by winner-take-all, it means that you had the same number of votes as seats, and the party or the political force that was strongest could often sweep all three seats. In a racial context, that often means that the dominant racial group can win all the seats, and a lot of the targets of voting rights litigation is against winner-take-all multi-seat districts. I'll just flag that with a handout about women's representation highlights an important fact of how structural can affect things, that women tend to do better in multi-seat districts. There's a lot of data about that. We're not suggesting winner-take-all multi-seat districts, though. We're looking at non-winner-take-all systems. And that's where there's this history of American sort of candidate-based systems, sometimes called proportional representation, but that can be kind of misunderstood to think we're talking about party list, kind of party-based systems. So candidate-based systems, like the cumulative voting system I referenced earlier in Illinois. But there's a ranked choice variety, sometimes called the single transferable vote, which essentially reliably represents the spectrum of candidates, or the voters who participate. So if you say you use it in a primary election in a three-seat district, you'll get that party representing three different perspectives within that party, kind of the left, center, and right. You bring that into the general election, you get the left, center, and right being elected. And so I wanted to quickly look at this multi-seat district way of thinking, or showing what this means in the context through some southern states. If you look at the map, one is you can see that these southern states at this point are incredibly distorted in the kind of representation that they get because they've become strongly Republican, and that Republican majority is overrepresented, that is actually the only way that Democrats are winning in some of these states is actually through black majority districts. And we showed, we drew real plans, and we just showed, like, what might they do if they didn't have to draw black majority districts, and in fact, they can wipe out Democrats entirely. And you can sort of see that in the, just look at Louisiana and Alabama as a couple of examples, not even close to Democrats having a chance to win, let alone an African American. If you do independent redistricting on the traditional criteria, it actually isn't that much different, because if you just draw nice square districts, it's still largely a Republican turf. If you do an independent commission that was actually really, really trying to help Democrats, you can actually get to a point of accommodating goals that, that people might have, but it, the districts have to start looking pretty, quote-unquote, outlandish and so on. Okay, and then I'll just compare as an example these multi-seat district plans, which, by the way, could be done statutorily. I know for Congress, we're not going to actually see it tomorrow, but we could have John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi of these strong parties get together and actually put this in as a statute. But it's I think, as an aspirational goal, we think it's important to put on the table because it so directly addresses, I think, the topic of these meetings. And you can see what they would do in these states. If you draw these plans, 3, 4, 5-seat district plans, from basically the North Carolina all the way to Texas across sort of the traditional black belt of the South, every African-American voter and every white voter would be in a position to help elect a candidate. You would sort of break up, I think, the excessively one-sided nature of what kind of Republican is winning. And this Illinois story that I alluded to earlier sort of shows what it can mean to have sort of a left, center, right of every constituency winning. And in the context of redistricting, I'll say that these multi-seat district plans, I would love to see them drawn in the process that Kathy in California has pioneered, that there's still a districting process. It's still good to use independent commissions, but I want to see them be less determinative and put voters in a different position to help elect people.
Thanks, Rob. Kathy?
One of the upsides of coming to the conference without any notes or preparation is that I actually really tried to listen to where a lot of the panels were going, and the conversations have made me think very hard about how you measure what happened in California. And I think, you know, clearly we're only one election cycle into it, so it's there's a lot of things that we still have to figure out. But also, I think, you know, anecdotally, how are we seeing some already changes in behavior in politics in California that might inform the conversation that's happening about how we reduce polarization at the national level. So I wanted to start with a story about the government shutdown around Obamacare in California. And you know, the thing that I was struck by was actually how California Republicans were responding to it. And, you know, in this was the first class of people who had been elected to represent in newly drawn districts under the districts that have been drawn by the Independent Redistricting Commission newly created, as well as elected under the new top two system. And what was striking was that there was a group of Republicans coming from the Central Valley representing Fresno and Tulare, not areas that normally one thinks of as being the bluer parts of California. Devin Nunes represented that group very vociferously calling out Ted Cruz, saying that he was leading Republicans down a moronic path and that the tactics were tantamount to lemmings jumping off of a cliff with suicide vests on. And he was very critical of the entire tactic, not only, I think, ideologically, but also the direction that certain members of his party were willing to take in terms of scorch and burn politics. And what's, I think, interesting is that during the redistricting debate, and for us, it's not a one-year, it was not a one-year campaign, it wasn't a two-year campaign, I think it was a decade-long fight to get to where we got to. The build-up to that involved some very hard conversations with a group of people that were very diverse in perspective, including the civil rights community, the good government community, unions, Democrats, Republicans, the business community. When I ask, or when I had long conversations with folks who were intimately involved in what was going on within the Republican Party, what they told me was that the redistricting battle for the Independent Commission was not just about fighting between Democrats and Republicans. This was a battle for the heart and soul of their party. They already were seeing the trends. In the most recent numbers in California is that Republicans now constitute, as a proportion of registered voters, 19% of the party. Voters. And what they saw was that scorch and burn policies of the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s had really pushed away a huge demographic, right? And in California, that huge demographic is immigrants, largely Latino, some Asian American. And what that's meant is that they have alienated a huge percentage of their population. This is a conversation where there were moderate Republicans. You could say that they are the, you know, sort of representing businesses, but I don't think it's just limited to that, who felt that the Republican Party in California had gone in a direction that they could no longer abide by. And we have a number of high-profile Republicans who have recently changed parties to independent because they feel that they've lost the battle within their own party. At the same time, I think that when they looked at the twin reforms of Top 2 and redistricting, they saw a glimmer of hope for themselves to try to regain that center. The behavior that we're already seeing that's changed because of these two reforms, part of it is about, you know, who's funding who. We saw SEIU, for the first time, develop a list of Republicans that they were going to be supporting through the primaries as well as the general elections. Short list, but still, they were looking at, you know, how they could put in what they considered to be a more moderate class of Republicans. And similarly, there were a lot of major Republican donors who are now looking at moderate Democrats and trying to get them through the two rounds of elections. That's significant because that's a change in the selection process that happens very early on in the primary system that may bode well for if what our goal is to create some portion of moderate center. If you look at just the numbers in California, we at the congressional level went from a dismal zero competitive seats to 10 competitive seats. What are competitive seats? The traditional definition is a seat where there is a relative balance of Democrats and Republicans where it could swing either way. I would say that that was not our ulterior goal when we pushed for the Independent Redistricting Commission. It is not a stated criteria, nor was it something that we were shooting for. Although I think that probably there were definitely people within the coalition of people who pushed for independent redistricting who very much hoped that there would be a certain number that would emerge in terms of competitive seats. I think what happened, though, that we were very concerned about was to think about removing the heavily tilted playing field that favored incumbent protection from the calculus of redistricting. And what we saw was that when the commission drew its lines, and in congressional districts alone, 23 incumbents found themselves bunking up with fellow incumbents. And so they were forced to make hard decisions about whether they were going to move themselves or remove themselves from the election. And in fact, 9 incumbents ended up being displaced from Congress. And that started a whole conversation about who would be participating. I think that probably the most overt reason that Common Cause got involved in the redistricting reform movement was to ask the question, why is there a process that is so removed, obscured from public participation? And if we bring the public back into it, can we have better results? I think part of that measure is that when we first saw the call go out for who might put their names in the hat for the 14 positions of independent redistricting commissioners, some 30,000 people applied. Now, I acknowledge that we were in the height of the economic downturn, so some people might have been applying because it seemed like a good job. Any job is a good job. But this is a very obscure issue, right? Not something that people wake up saying, I think I'd like to be a redistricting commissioner.
I think some of us might.
Some of you would, yes. Some of you would consider relocating to California. But I think the other piece of it is that 20,000 people stepped up to provide testimony to the commission. And I think that when you consider that some of the changes that we're now implementing may result in a much broader participation in the process itself, in California, anyways, I think that potentially bodes well in making our democratic processes much more representative of that larger polity. And in California, anyways, I would say that would lean towards moderation, not towards extremism.
Thank you, Kathy. Tom?
Good morning. I have a number of points to make. I'm limited time to do them, so I'm going to try to string them together. And I'll say up front, I recognize that some of them may seem to be contradictory. But I think it was the first panelist yesterday morning who noted that demographic change was a significant part of the reason for political polarization. I want to second that, but modify it. I think that it is fear, obviously, of demographic change, and more pointedly, it is fear of the political consequences of demographic change that are a large part of the explanation for increasing political polarization. I think that conclusion leads to a couple of suggestions, recommendations. First of all, I think it means that in addition to spending time discussing and addressing issues of elected officials themselves, their ideologies, their polarization, as well as their connection to voters and donors, it means we have to pay attention to the general public and address that fear of demographic change. So, Michael, that's your next, I think that should be your next convening, to discuss the fear of the political consequences of demographic change and how they might be addressed. And I mean in a more targeted manner that focuses on those political consequences rather than the usual approach to these issues, which I would categorize under the label, we are the world, can't we all just get along programming directed at the public. I think there needs to be a vigorous discussion of how do you address the fear of the political consequences of demographic change across this country. But the fact that there is this predominant fear, this growing fear of demographic change that, as we all know, is exploited by some political leaders, means that there has been a perpetuation, if not an acceleration, of racially polarized voting across the country. I know that this is certainly the experience of the Latino community, where we may have had beliefs, views, dreams some decade ago, a decade ago, that perhaps in states like California, racially polarized voting might actually decrease. It is not. It is still persistent and significant, even in the progressive island of California, where Kathy and I come from. That persistence of racially polarized voting means that we have to continue to pay attention to the depressed, deterred levels of political participation in minority communities. A lot of that stems from the fact that under existing structures, they are consistently outvoted, at least in local and state legislative races, and believe, therefore, there's no reason to vote. Vote doesn't count, there's no reason to vote. So you have to create structures like majority-minority districts to raise that depressed and deterred voter participation within those communities. I would suggest to you that in responding to this demographic fear, we have to resist the temptation to decelerate the change that the public may fear. And I think that means that we have to evaluate changes in structure from that perspective. Does this structural change have a danger of decelerating the change in response to that demographic fear? That is not to say that I would oppose multi-member districts in all circumstances. As Rob and I discussed yesterday, I think you have to pay attention to the local context, and the creation of majority-minority districts can, over years, be a transition to a multi-member system once you have addressed that phenomenon of depressed and deterred voter participation within minority communities. Second major point is this: that demographic fear is irrational. So today, only 37% of the total population of this country is comprised of people of color. And if you look at those who are potential voters, we're really talking about a quarter of the population. And we already have this phenomenon and have lived with for a decade or more the political consequences of this demographic fear. If we start with this when we're only at a quarter of potential voters in this country, can you imagine how long we're going to be in this wilderness if we don't do something to address it? This reinforces the point about making sure that what we pursue does not decelerate the change that folks are afraid of, or that some proportion of the electorate is afraid of. It is also quite clear that demographic fear is irrational as a long-term political strategy. Look at California if you want proof of that. But it doesn't mean that it's not being pursued vigorously and seemingly without cease by one of the major parties in this country. That then means that within majority-minority districts, yes, it is true, they tend not to be competitive districts. But I have to say the obvious, that is not a predetermined outcome. That is largely the result of one major party's seeming consistent intent on alienating at least every Latino voter in this entire country, the exception of Ted Cruz and a few of his followers. But really, the Republican Party is on a path that would lead them to the kinds of consistent polarization within the Latino community that shows 75-80% in support of the other party. That means, once more, that we have to ensure that we are not overreacting to that demographic fear by concluding that somehow majority-minority districts, by definition, have to be non-competitive. They can be competitive, particularly if you create structures like Top 2 in California, where the competition is not in the usual bipartisan framework. Which leads to my third and final point, which is this. Demographic change, despite the fact that I've asserted that demographic fear is irrational, the demographic change is occurring is unquestionably significant. This country is going to be dramatically different as the growth in the Latino community, the Asian American community accelerate and continue. This country is going to be dramatically different. And so my final cautionary note is this: we ought not assume that such significant demographic change will not lead to significant changes in our political structure. I think it was suggested in the discussion on the last panel that we ought not assume necessarily that the current bipartisan framework will continue to exist 25, 30, 40 years from now. I think Kathy has just discussed and given you the data that suggests the Republican Party is pretty close to its own demise in the state of California, the largest state in the country. So we need to be sure that our solutions are not premised upon the continued long-term existence of the existing bipartisan competitive framework. Political competition in the future may be in a different form, particularly in a transition to a different two-party future. It's certainly conceivable in California that in 20 or 25 years, there will be two major parties in California, except that one of them will not be the Republican Party. And we have to be sure that our reforms are not premised upon the long-term existence of the existing bipartisan framework. I'll give one example, just because I have to take a little poke at my friend Kathy, which is the creation of the commission, which frankly Malda proposed, but I have to say that in operation in this last redistricting round, the commission that was selected did a good job. I give them a B in terms of their work, maybe even a B+, which we did not expect. But the structure of the redistricting commission is premised on the long-term existence of the current bipartisan framework. That is to say, it is not nimble enough to adjust to a transitional period where one of the two major parties is at the low, low levels of support that the Republican Party currently has in California. So three main points with the recommendations that go with them. Demographic fear is a major driver of polarization on the political side. That demographic fear is irrational, but that demographic change is unquestionably significant.
Okay, well, I'm going to take moderator's privilege at this point. I said I was going to have questions first, but I think the comments of the panel were stimulating enough that maybe we should look for responses. I know Rob, you went first, but do you have anything that you wanted to add quickly before we go to the audience?
I'll just say briefly, if you go to Georgia and South Carolina and Alabama, you would say that they also think there might not be a bipartisan framework, but it'll be a very different one, right? That, you know, the Democrats went from running those chambers a decade ago to not even running in half the state legislative races, not even contesting half the races in the last election. So you have these different regions of the country in very different places. And of course, one of the parts of our polarization that I think relates to redistricting is that you get off the 50-50 dime by 3 points in almost all these places, from Oregon to Georgia to wherever, and it becomes a safe seat. So that to create a truly competitive seat is almost, you add an incumbency and then a 50-50 district is no longer competitive anymore, right? It's like it's really, really hard to create competitive districts, but also we're creating this very locked down different places based on the power of the brands at this point. So I think that's just sort of part of the complexity and why we think these multi-seat systems where, you know, part of that middle person has to be elected with both Democrats and Republicans when you're representing the left, center, and right. You kind of intrinsically get a different kind of person in there.
Are there any comments from the audience to respond to the panels?
Yeah. I just wanted to pick up on the point that Thomas was
I just want to pick up on the point that Thomas just made about the diversification, the demographic diversification of the country, and how that's just going to be bringing about fundamental shifts in the landscape. And a lot of the things that we're talking about in the past 2 days on these issues will be resolved in a very different context. And so I think that's a very important point, and it may make some aspects of what we've been talking about harder and some aspects easier, in a sense. And just a little bit of a paid advertisement here. One of the we are in the process of funding some folks at CAP and AEI, so Rui Teixeira and Carlin Bowman at AEI, and they'll be working with some demographers to do a forward-looking demographic projection of the sort that the Census Department, when it was amply funded, used to do around these patterns of diversification. And the idea is to have both of these institutions, center-right, center-left, kind of agree on a common set of facts, and then to engage in a set of dialogues about both the political and the policy implications of that. And I mention that because I think they are very open up front to input around the issues and the vantage points that need to be factored into that analysis. And then also, you know, some of the topics of the issues and that they'll be discussing, it's meant to be kind of a very participatory, illuminating set of discussions around these same issues. So I think that just something as we think about, gosh, this seems hard, are there any degrees of freedom? I think the idea would be more information about what the landscape will look like in the future might help the emergence of some of these new possibilities.
Thank you. Marcia, I think, had a comment in back.
Yes. Both the panel before and this panel has me reflecting on, and I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts on the trends that are happening with regard to the reorganization that's happening in counties where cities are peeling off from counties. I'm talking about like the Sandy Springs and Dunwoodies who are peeling off from Fulton County in Atlanta and creating these islands around where they have a majority-minority county, but creating majority-white islands, and which I think is in response to the demographic trends that are happening and what that means for political participation. Mm-hmm. And the other trend in response to the economic crisis where emergency managers are being instituted and put in place in cities where, again, there's a majority minority populations and what that means for participation and how that fits into the redistrictings to come.
Marcia, I would just say quickly, I think that what you've cited are examples of why we really need to address this demographic fear, and we need to get ahead of that issue. And again, I think a lot of the programming to address demographic fear has been at the very individual level of we are the world, can't we all just get along, when in fact we need to be addressing more or less directly the fear of the political consequences of demographic change. For example, again, I think this ought to be the subject of an entire convening, but one thing that I think ought to occur is that we need to document and be clear and disseminate so everyone understands there is nothing to fear. We have a number of majority-minority cities, counties across the country that have not resulted in dramatic change in the kinds of things that Americans tend to value. But that's not documented. So when you don't know that a lot of these majority-minority political jurisdictions, that transition has not resulted in some dramatic and harmful change to folks who used to be in the majority, you can at least begin to assuage the fears who see that happening in their own community. It's just that right now they don't have any context in which to perceive what's going to happen in their own community except to perceive that it's not going to be the same city, put fill in the name, that they raise their children in or that they expect it to continue to be the case all the way through their grandchildren's lives.
Can I just add really quickly about Georgia? I think it's just sort of part of this southern story that I think has been maybe under-examined. But, you know, all those southern states went from having, if you sort of take out partisan calculations, just the, those in running the state legislature were black-white coalitions 15 years ago. Every single state legislative chamber, you know, was run by Democrats with black-white coalitions. Now, you know, almost every single state legislative chamber except a couple on the borders, like Kentucky, are run by Republican legislators who have, they're basically an all-white legislature. But one of the things they're doing with localities, like in Georgia, and they often are stripping any kind of home rule powers, but even just right now, they're changing the election date kind of unilaterally from November to like May over the objections of localities. And so like those kinds of local decisions of how to deal with those things are often now being stripped away also.
Thank you. Well, John Hill, Rick, did you have a comment? Did I see you saying you wanted to comment?
Oh, no.
Okay,
I mean,
sorry.
I might,
I thought I saw your chair. Sorry. So John Cowell and then Jonathan.
Hi, everyone. John Cowell with the Brennan Center. When people think about redistricting, which they don't do very often, they either think about it in terms of, you know, my community's not represented, or they think about it in terms of politicians who are controlling the process and perpetuating their own interests. And I guess since this is a conference on polarization, and we've been talking a lot about the need to moderate the tendencies of politicians, I'm curious about viewing it through that lens as well. And I guess the other part of my question is that the history of reform has been a funny one here where, for the most part, there's been a fracturing of what might be a normal progressive coalition around reform that tends to be kind of the good government groups pushing a competitiveness frame or some kind of, you know, social engineering, and you have you know, community groups and people of color organizations hostile to the idea of elite commissions. That led to a lot of impasse, and you had, you know, Ohio and places like that where nothing happened. But then, interesting, in the last few years, you had Florida and California where even like groups like yours opposed it, but change happened. And I guess I'm wondering, is it a viable strategy to oppose change when other forces are driving it and changes that may be, you know, developed by people where you're not at the table?
Mm-hmm. Kathy, first of all, I lived a certain portion of my life in Singapore, so I heavily support social engineering, and I believe it. It's a viable option. Anyways, but setting aside that scary, scary thought, I actually think that what happened in California, you know, the opposition that came from civil rights groups, including my own former civil rights group, because I was with what is now AAAJ, then Asian Pacific American Legal Center. You know, the concerns came from partly, I think, a fear that if you look at who participates in these kinds of things, you're going to end up with a commission that will not be particularly representative, that will speak for parties or political powers that already exist, and that will largely exclude us when we finally got a seat at the table in the legislature, and it's not fair. It sets aside the question about whether it's fair when the legislature draws the lines. I think what's key is that once it was implemented, or as it was being implemented, there was significant foundation support for many of these groups to be involved in recruiting people to become commissioners or put their names in the hat. So that 30,000 didn't come by accident. You know, it came from a lot of heavy recruitment. And then to participate in the process of mobilizing people to testify before the commission. I think that, you know, to some extent it speaks to that earlier conversation about what happened in Arizona. When you invest in a reform, but you don't think about sort of the implementation of that and how you get people to the table, you will essentially just recreate the existing power structure. And if you think about who usually participates in voting, it's not a particularly representative sample unless you make extra effort to get a broader cross-section of the population out to participate. So same goes with redistricting, but even more extreme. We did end up with 14 people who were surprisingly diverse, you know, including Pacific Islander, Native American, you know, 3 Asian Americans, you know, somebody who was biracial, 2 Latinos. So, I mean, it was surprisingly diverse, but at the same time, I think significantly it was because of that investment in resources. Now, if we think about, you know, what's the potential for other states, I don't think that it's necessarily a one-size-fits-all. I've actually been talking to about a dozen different states who are looking at some form of change in their redistricting process. And, you know, in California, it was a given that we would never have competition as one of the criteria. It was a given that we were going to prioritize communities of interest. It was a given that we were going to write incumbents into a very low level of consideration by the commission, and that we would have a requirement for diversity on the panel. I don't know that those are necessarily givens in other states, given the political environment. I think if in the long run you're looking at some other types of reforms, and this is what I would say to Rob, you can't begin to have that conversation, honestly, until you divest incumbents of that sense of God-given right that since I was elected to this district, it's mine to draw. Right, and it's mine to, you know, write the inheritance plan. You know, who I bequeath it to once I decide not to run for this position anymore. Right, and so in some ways, if you had that broader vision of, you know, going to multi-member districts with proportional voting, I still think you have to go through some step, whether that's commissions or something else, that takes that power away from incumbents and people who have a self-interested reason for drawing those lines and puts it in the hands of somebody else, because only then can you start to talk about what's possible in terms of, you know, decentralizing that role.
I just wanted to add quickly to that comment, which is a couple different points. One is just on the issue of polarization and redistricting. Given the environment we're in, where a 53% district is really becoming a safe district, and you look at House races, by the way, in the 2012 election, just amazing how hard it was to win in the other party's turf, and it just didn't happen really at all. Or they didn't win a new seat. Some incumbents held on, but even very few, and most of those are leaving, actually going to 2014. And so then the primary is everything, and then so if you have a 53% district and the primary is everything, and the primary electorate's pretty small and more partisan, you know, they're not gonna look a whole lot different than a 57% district, particularly if they really are unlikely to lose in the 53% district. And actually in California, even with the shakeup with competitiveness came from shaking up incumbency. The landscape is actually not any more competitive on their competitive terrain.
I disagree with that. So.
Oh well,
you're not saying that every single district is competitive. That's never the goal, because that's not how people choose to live. But to say that there wasn't an increase in the number of competitive seats, I think there's been a number of studies not done by Common Cause that have shown that there has been a significant increase, doubling the number of seats that were competitive.
Maybe in the state legislature, but in Congress, it's not.
Okay,
but just the other quick point about incumbency. I'm just going to say. So I think that it's very contextual, and that's where we've seen, certainly with things like some of the advances for ranked choice voting, have almost always come out of city councils where there's been some context where they're supportive. But I think nationally, I think just to leave a number that make sure that when we're talking about redistricting, everyone knows this number, you know, Democrats can't take back the House right now without a 55% support of the electorate. It's an incredible skew, much bigger than any electoral college skew that we can have. We have a dynamic that creates a conversation to be had about how best to address that. And also the Republican conversation is, in that environment, are they ready to change enough when they can't lose without falling below 45%? So there's a conversation on both sides that can happen.
Never let it be said redistricting is not exciting. Jonathan, I think you're waiting to make a point.
Actually, waiting to ask a couple of questions, one for Kathy and one for Rob. For Kathy, why was competitiveness not a criterion? One might have thought that would be the main thing one was trying to achieve with redistricting. And for Rob, it sounds like the distinction between winner-take-all and non-winner-take-all multi-seat districts is important, but I don't understand it. Wouldn't a multi-seat, if there are three seats, wouldn't the top three vote-getters be the winners?
Okay. I'm going to ask you all to answer these very quickly. I think there was a point Kathy actually made earlier that may go a bit to more of the dysfunction conversation and the role of redistricting, and that had to do with how people live. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of writing and different conversations. There was a recent New York Times article that really said, look, you can't draw a better district. You can't draw a more proportional district. Democrats are so concentrated in urban centers. Republicans are situated so much more efficiently around the country that in fact, and this might go to your question, that truly competitive proportional districts really aren't possible
right.
in the way. And so is redistricting even, like, should it be a high priority as we think about, again, the secret sauce, like, where does it fit in?
Competitiveness, right. That's part of it. That in California, Democrats live on the coast, Republicans live, inland in very stereotypical terms. So if you were to require competitiveness, in fact, you would force people into drawing spaghetti-like districts that didn't make any sense, that would have to be, 100 miles apart. So I think, the other piece of it is, frankly, we saw Arizona caught up in litigation for, a whole decade over what is competitiveness, and it just didn't make sense because you can achieve greater competition, whether that's at the primary or the general level, through other criteria that don't require this prescriptive decision about what percentage Democrats and Republicans need to be in every district. And that comes from saying that you can't favor, incumbents, saying that you, shouldn't be looking at where incumbents live, saying that you can't draw communities of interest based on, incumbents' interests. Let me say this. That New York Times article, what's fascinating to me is, I haven't had a chance to talk to the authors, but it seems to me that one of the things that they drew a lot of districts. I don't think that they took into consideration communities of interest because, frankly, from an academic's perspective, that's messy stuff. You got to go figure out, from a grassroots perspective, where do you start and stop the lines of a community? And so, yes, you can draw lines based on, maps and numbers without ever talking to the people who live in them. I think once you take into consideration communities of interest, it changes the whole dynamic, and that's what happened in California. And then, the last piece, just in terms of, why it is that in California, I think top two and redistricting were not intended necessarily to be implemented at the same time. But I think it was very much a similar conversation that was going on. We had just watched a whole decade worth of dysfunction in our state legislature where gridlock was so severe that our moderate Republican governor, if you call him moderate, certainly his fellow Republicans would, could not achieve agreement with his own Republican legislators in the state legislature. And that battle became so severe that internal conversation within the Republican Party spilled over in terms of a couple of different initiatives to try to win back the center of the Republican Party. So I think seen in that light, I mean, that's, there are many lights to see redistricting in top two, but seen in that light, I think people have to ask, you know, how is that conversation playing itself out in the rest of the country? I mean, there are a number of other states now. Colorado is considering a top four system. Massachusetts is thinking about something. There's a number of states that are looking at primary reform and redistricting reform. And those are conversations that are driven by a lot of different forces that, frankly, if you want to look at where bipartisan dialogue is happening, it's around those, around what those reforms should look like in those states. I am so sorry to speak and run, but I've got to catch a shuttle that might take me back home to the West Coast today. So thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Shall I briefly address this winner-take-all point?
I want to move on to just one more point, and then the winner-take-all question, maybe you can include it in your wrap-up comments.
Okay.
And I think one of the questions I think that comes up with redistricting reform is sort of a pragmatism question. I think, you know, Rob, there hasn't been a lot of objection to the idea that proportional representation, multi-member districts may provide the best path to the best type of representation, but the real question always is, how realistic is that? Can we get there from here? I think Tom proposed the idea that, look, that there's intermediary steps to get there, and how do we get there? And the question I kind of want to lay over the top of it is, does it have to be all or nothing all the time? Is there easier routes to reforming most of redistricting, which is at state and local level, without necessarily engaging the congressional process in the same way, that may allow some progress, allow citizen participation, and actually accelerate the expectations around redistricting that then may push federal reform? But as we think about not just the ideas and concepts around reform, I was hoping you two could comment a little bit on pragmatically what can we do and what does that look like over the next 3, 4, 5 years, rather than sort of the idea of what is, you know, what's the deal of proportional representation, but what can we do and how are we looking at these approaches? And Tom, I know you've had a chance to speak for a little bit, so I'll let you jump in.
I want to focus on what you said about incremental change and a menu of changes. I think that's absolutely right. With respect to redistricting commissions, let me just say this. I certainly am no fan of legislative redistricting. I litigated against the last legislatively drawn maps in California. They were objectively corrupt in both process and result. And despite that, and despite what I believe to be a very strong voting rights case, they were upheld by the federal court system. So I'm no fan of legislative redistricting, but I would say that because the redistricting commission took the place of that in California, we missed the opportunity to make sure that we were addressing, in places that still have legislative redistricting, reforms that would prevent some of the objective corruptness of the last process in California. And I think that's a shame. I think we need to look at a menu of changes. With respect to redistricting commissions, I think I want to just make two comments based on what came up previously. I think, and I was not at MALDEF when the decision was made to oppose the initial redistricting commission initiative, but I believe that the reason the process succeeded this time around was because of who the commissioners were. But there is absolutely no guarantee that we're going to end up in future redistrictings with a similarly constituted set of commissioners, and that is the concern. First of all, I think that to Kathy and the framers' credit, there was a real effort to make sure that there would be diversity among the commissioners. Unfortunately, that's now being challenged in court by Ward Connerly, who is using his own Proposition 209 that, among other things, prohibits preferences in government employment to challenge the very diversity provisions that were necessary and written into the redistricting commission scheme. Second, I think that the real issue with the redistricting commission scheme in California, and I put this out there for those who are putting them together elsewhere, including MALDEF has just drafted a commission scheme for a local jurisdiction that wants to shift from, that there are proponents who want to shift from at-large to single-member districts, don't want the lines drawn by the existing elected at-large city council, so we've put together a commission mechanism for them. But I think you have to be very cautious about not trying too hard to eliminate all of the politics from an inherently political process. And that's part of the danger, is that you end up masking and hiding some of the things that are going on. So I think that's responsive to most of your suggestions.
Pragmatism.
Pragmatism. Well, here we are in New York City, and back in the 1930s, you had Mayor LaGuardia, and we were hearing about the lovely
Tammany Hall machine, but not everyone liked the Tammany Hall machine, including LaGuardia, including Franklin Roosevelt. And they pushed for proportional representation, actually the single transferable vote, ranked choice voting variety. And it won 1936, and they used it for five elections during what a lot of people think is the city's golden age of governance with LaGuardia and a very different kind of city council. And it lost, and we could get into the stories of why and sort of anti-communist fervor and so on. But the and fear of diversity, which was often Cincinnati had it in a number of cities, and one of the immediate outcomes was representation of diversity, which in the 30s and 40s and 50s wasn't always fully appreciated. But there is a history to build on and to learn from. The Illinois story, I think, is fascinating. What we've seen, there's more than 100 cities right now that use a non-winner-take-all system, and maybe I'll briefly say to Jonathan what that means. So you're right. If a multi-seat district, you have the same number of votes as seats, and you know a majority puts one vote on each candidate that reflects their point of view, they can win all the seats. The simplest way to not have that outcome is to say everyone has one vote. And that actually was used nationally in Japan. It's used in about 30 cities around the United States in school boards. And variants of that are used in a lot of other places. In fact, it's required in any at-large election in Connecticut. You can't have the number of votes, same number of votes as seats. You have fewer votes than seats. So that kind of breaks up majorities. The ranked choice element makes that one vote more powerful and allows you to support more than one person, so allows a political force to run more than one person, and it creates incentives to reach out. But the math is the same. In a 3-seat district, it takes a little over 25% to win rather than 50%. In a 5-seat district, it takes about 17%. So practically, we've got the Voting Rights Act. We have the State Voting Rights Act in California. We should have more State Voting Rights Act. One is almost passed in Washington. Just right now, we're talking with people in a city in California of almost 200,000 people about using cumulative voting in a California Voting Rights Act case. So it can be part of the menu of options that can come out of those cases. And I think we need to look at certain states with the possibility of moving this forward. And I'll just pick one example of Michigan, which is where you have the same kind of partisan skew that you have in the congressional skew. And if you do redistricting commissions, it doesn't really undo that. And it certainly doesn't create the values of every voter in every part of the state being able to help elect someone. And the Midwest Democracy Center did a really good report about redistricting and alternatives and had presented a couple of really good ways that you could move forward in Michigan. And I think if we start putting these things on the table and apply them practically, building on a history of their use in cities, there's real opportunities to move forward.
Great, thank you. I just wanted to summarize some of the conversation really quickly before we break. We've talked a lot about various types of reforms, and we certainly have seen a lot of different types of reforms around the country. We have sort of the constrained legislative model that we see in places like Iowa. What will be up next, the types of redistricting we'll see in New York State, certainly Florida, what is proposed recently by Secretary of State Husted in Ohio. The idea that you have the legislature still drawing the districts, but you're constrained by rules around those districts. And some of these, I think, can be beneficial. The question before us and some of these opportunities is there any belief necessarily jurisdictionally that, say, the New York legislature is going to behave like the Iowa legislature and restrain itself from intervening and changing some of the lines in a way that Iowa has been very successful in doing. We have independent commissions we've seen in California and Arizona, and California certainly has offered a really good opportunity for us to look and evaluate the impacts of commissions in both a partisan and sort of the partisan analysis. The challenge before us now is we have at least 74 congressional districts that were drawn under an independent commission. Does that help us look and see as we look at the data to try and figure out what this means and the proportionality? The flip side of that coin is 53 of those 74 are in California and drawn by a single commission. So what does that really tell us? We have a chance to look at Arizona, and Arizona's been working since 2000, certainly a hotbed of litigation. But one thing I think is really important to point out about Arizona is in 2000, when Arizona initially had its opportunity to fill its 5-member commission, there were 311 applicants. In 2010, that number dropped to 79 applicants. After the litigation around the commission, they had to reconstitute the commission. It dropped to 19 applicants. So I think that goes very much to Tom's point, that you have a commission, and how effective that commission is very, very, it's absolutely essential that the size of the pool filling the commissioners is large enough to actually make sure that commission works. And so there's lots of sort of devil in the details as we think about the value of commissions. And of course, we also have to think about, in fact, is redistricting reform going to be the way to go? How much should we continue to invest? Is sorting enough? And, you know, how much should we be thinking about competitiveness? I realize that we have a tendency to think in terms of D's and R's all the time. And that's how we determine whether or not government's working, is how the D's and R's are living and working together. But, in fact, when you talk to citizens, when you talk to individuals, when you go into the streets and you say, do you want competitive districts? They say, yes, absolutely, I want a competitive district. And you say, fine, that district is going to look like a bunch of new neighbors and a bunch of people living 50 miles away in a completely different community with a completely different tax base, with a completely different set of employers and everything else. That's what that competitive district has to look like. And they turn around and say, well, I don't want that. Right? I just want my elected officials to be accountable to me. I want a level of representation that's meaningful. So we also have to think about the value of simply saying the answer is just having equal numbers of D's and R's, and whether or not individuals are truly going to feel represented, and whether or not we're really going to accomplish a feeling amongst the electorate that we're actually solving dysfunction simply by throwing a factor of competitiveness over the top. So we've had a lot of interesting conversation today, and I want to thank everyone. And because of the time, I want to give you all quite literally 30 seconds to wrap up and wrap up your comments today. And thank you so much for your time.
Well, I'll just use 10 seconds, which is if you could take the women's representation report that I brought, then I don't have to try to lug it home on the train. So there's someone in the chairs here, and I think it's actually a very interesting element to this that often we don't look at gender and the impact of districting, but it's in fact part of the conversation. So take a look at that and grab one.
Thank you. And I'll just quickly reiterate that I think it's critical that one lens to evaluate all proposals to address political polarization have to take into account demographic fear and what the consequences of the change that's behind that might be, as well as how we might address the issues that are behind the fear in the portion of the electorate that is being exploited in that way.